This is Christmas, the Monster Podcast. I'm kidding. I did it the wrong way. I don't care.
Hello, and welcome to the first episode of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? The podcast version of the blog, If This Is a Blog, Then What's Christmas? If you're a regular reader of that blog, then you've probably got a pretty good idea of what this podcast is going to cover. If you've never heard of it, or it's been a while since you've read it, then you may not have much of a clue from the name of the podcast. But just to give you an idea, the blog started about 10 years ago and was firmly rooted in the advertising industry from a creative perspective. I was a creative director in advertising then, I am now, and I spent years exploring various parts of the industry and various parts of creativity and the process of creativity. As the blog went on, I looked at other creative industries and wrote posts about film or music or writing. And that's kind of where the blog has ended up at this stage. Now, in recent years, I think like a lot of us, I've got more into podcasts, partly because I now have a long commute in a car. And I listened to quite a few podcasts, and I thought it might be interesting to see if I could breathe new life into the blog by taking it into the world of podcasts. So episode one is going to be me interviewing Dave Dye, who's one of the great art directors in the world of advertising. He's, you know, been a great art director, a great creative, a great creative director. He's started his own agency. He started his own agencies. So there's been a few of those. He's worked for big multinational agencies, he's worked for smaller ones, and I thought it would be really interesting to talk to him about why he did what he did, how he did what he did, when and who with, what drove those decisions, and how he's got to where he's got to. I've known Dave for 15 years. He joined Abbott Mead Vickers BBDO when I was there, I think probably about 2001. So I've known him for a while, and through those aspects of his career. I didn't know him at the very beginning, so it'd be really interesting to talk about that. But since then, I've had a few long conversations and cups of tea about his life and where things have taken certain turns and certain directions. But for you guys to hear the same kind of thing, I think could be very interesting too. So let's see what happens when we chat. Thanks very much for taking the time to have this conversation.
Pleasure, Ben.
Okay, so what I wanted to do is sort of go over an overall career thing, because I think it'd be interesting to know why and how and when you did certain things that took you from the very beginning of advertising to, you know, for instance, the very top of a multinational corporation's creative department, to your own place, to a different your own place, and then back into the world of agencies. And maybe if we just have a conversation about that, we can find out the sort of motivations behind any of those decisions. But can I just start by asking you why you wanted to get into advertising in the first place?
Well, I think like a lot of people from my generation, there didn't used to be a lot of creative outlets. So if you could draw or were good at art, people would flag up advertising or design as one of the sort of options. And I think most people who went to art college, you know, that was the creative outlet at the time. You know, there wasn't obviously Google, Apple, gaming, and a million other things. And I think at the time, I think I got my first job in advertising in 1985. When you look back at that as a year, it was a very influential business. You know, it wasn't long. It hadn't been long since Saatchi's apparently had put Margaret Thatcher in power, for better or worse. You would find people like John Hegarty on national TV being interviewed by Terry Wogan, bizarrely. It was a very glamorous business. And in terms of the work, it was quite a sort of intelligent, well thought of thing to do. You know, the sort of goal was at the time to try and do things that had never been done. So the thought of, you know, the exciting thing for me was to commit an idea to paper and then the general public would see it. You know, that seemed an incredible thing to do, whether it was on a poster or a TV. And I would look around at all of the work going on. A lot of it would have been funny. And I thought, that'd be a great thing to do, things that, you know, would make people like my mum and dad laugh. So I kind of tried to get into, I was kind of in a design studio in a very lowly position, and thought I'll switch to advertising.
So did you say you were at an art college before that happened?
It's an art college of sorts, yeah. Loughton College in Essex, sort of doing fine art for a bit and graphics. Didn't really learn much, wasn't a tremendous amount of help.
But it set you on this path, so good old Loughton Art College.
I guess it did in a kind of roundabout way, yeah. I mean, I think the design, the bit I mainly remember from the graphics course was them talking about this very weird guy called Bob Gill, who didn't seem to take any... they talked about him like he was a bit of a freak. They said he doesn't seem to care about design. He's all about the idea. But they didn't say it in good for him. They said it in like he was a bit of a punky sort of freak guy. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't pay any attention to his typefaces, or he's the colours are so random. And it was very disparaging. But they told us a bit about him. And I thought, God, I love this guy's work. Why is he, you know? But they would have loved all the sort of, you know, Gaudi, well-spaced, delicate little fonts on, you know, jam jars and things. And I remember seeing Bob Gill's work and thinking, it's really funny. It's like very, it was kind of like punky stuff. He'd rip things up and cut things out. And there was sort of no design, you know, it didn't fit. You couldn't feel the design. It just felt like with his bare hands, he'd made bits of communication. And I thought it was very inspiring. So I guess I got that from college. It's the first person I sort of learnt about that I thought, God, he seems great.
Yeah, funny the sort of what they call the inciting incident, I guess. But so if you were in 1985 in a lowly graphics department, and I could be wrong about this, but I remember seeing your name in the 92 DNAD. Maybe you got in a few years earlier. But what happened between 85 and say 92?
Well, God, slightly a long story, but I didn't know anyone in advertising. Didn't really know much about advertising, so I had a book full of, I would have not one clue of how you get together. You know, I see people now would come in with their books and it's all divided into campaigns and different media and it's all very organised. And I literally thought, I'd like to go into advertising, so I'll do some ads. What should I do them about? And I'll do one on Durex and one on this and two on that. And then I'd have some pictures, and it was all very random stuff, really. It was clueless. So I look back and there were some quite funny little bits and pieces in, but it was clueless in terms of what I wanted to go in. And then I would make these exhaustive lists, which I still have, being a world-class hoarder, and they would be, and they'd have things on them from illustration companies, design companies, ad agencies, all sorts of places. I didn't know the difference between one and another. They seemed to be involved in advertising in some way, and I would trek around them with my big A1 portfolio full of funny little drawings in. And then I would send out a 50-page hand-drawn batch of work, you know, because this is, without it sounding too Victorian, this is pre-colour photocopiers and photocopiers to some extent. So I would hand-draw each ad, colour it in, send off a batch with a little note essentially saying, I'm really good, I'm going to work really hard, blah, blah, blah. And I would never hear anything. And you can imagine each one of these 50-page documents by hand possibly would have taken 10, 15 hours. So it was a lot of investment to get nothing back. So in desperation, I thought, I don't know what to do. I can't really redo all the ads again. I'll write a different note. And it was in desperation of sort of just not knowing. I just didn't know what to write. I thought, I don't know whether to say, I'm clueless, can you give us advice, or I'm amazing, you should get me in, or I didn't know whether to call them Sir, Bob.
Who were you writing to, and how did you know who to write to?
Well, it was a ragtag bunch of sort of creative directors and a head of a design company, and I didn't have a very focused list. I just had names that I can't remember where I was getting my names from, probably from the back of Creative Review or one of the magazines, I would imagine. So anyway, so I kind of wrote this letter, which said, I sort of had this idea for a letter, which the idea, I guess, was it started very formally. So let's say it was David Abbott. It would say, Dear Mr. Abbott Esquire, I forthwith, blah, 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 whatever the long words I thought were fancy at the time. Yeah. And then it was crossed out. And then it got slightly less formal and slightly less formal. And then it would say, and then by the end it said, "Dear Davy baby, I've got nothing to do," you know, or something like that. So basically the idea was it went from an incredibly formal thing, crossed out, less formal, less formal, less formal, to very friendly, cheeky. And it was partly out of desperation, I thought. But there was a sort of truth in it, which is I didn't know how to even address them. Anyway, that with the same work that got me a lot of interviews, ironically, because most of these little booklets would go right via the secretary first, not direct to the creative director. And the secretaries liked it because it just made them laugh, you know, slightly honest, silly thing. And it got me lots of, all of a sudden, exactly the same work with a different opening note got me lots of interviews. I went to see one guy who went through my book. He was in a wheelchair, went through my book, gave me some advice. At the end of it, he said, okay, maybe you want to consider going to an advertising college or, you know, to sort of get a bit more of an education in this area, which was an incredibly depressing thing to hear because I'd probably left college 2 years before and I'd probably spent a year trying to get into advertising in this sort of haphazard way. So out of desperation, I said, do you have any real briefs? I'd never seen a real brief. It sounded like such an exotic thing. I said, do you have any real briefs around that I could work on, you know, from a portfolio? So he kind of puffed and went, and he kind of looked around, literally just reached for the nearest bit of paper. You know, there was no thought put in it. And he looked at it and gave it to me. So I said, oh, it's amazing, great. Could I come back next week and show you what I've done? And he said, yeah, just speak to the girl outside or whatever. Anyway, so booked in a date the next week, got outside really excited with my new brief, first brief I've ever seen, which was for Findus Frozen Monge 2. So at the time I thought, oh, how exciting, an actual brief. I didn't think Frozen Monge 2, Jesus Classic. Christ. Went away for a week, was just up all hours, scrawling on bits of paper, just any, if there was ink on a paper, that counted to me as an idea. So I was just thinking, there's another one. So following week came round and I'd had to see another creative director with my portfolio before I took the work back. So I'd kind of seen him, the booklet had got me through to him. I left that then to see this guy, Barry Brooks, his name was, in a wheelchair, with what I'd done with the brief he'd given me. So I was ushered in and he said, oh, come in, put your photo there. Let's just have a look. So I thought, that's weird. He's only saw it a week ago. I guess he wants to refresh his memory. So he started to go through it again and he was sort of saying the same things. I don't really get that one. I think you want to, oh, God, how weird. And then towards the end of it, I realized that not only had he forgotten that he'd seen me, he'd forgotten every bit of work in there. He just, within a week, I'd been erased from his mind. So I thought, what an awkward situation. I've got to embarrass him now and say, well, obviously you saw me last week. So I said, I did the best I could. I said, thanks very much for reminding me of that stuff again. That's great. I did the work, you know, you asked me to do. And he went, oh, yeah. Then now he's feeling slightly embarrassed because he's given me a brief. He's forgotten who the hell I am. Obviously, that's how much effort and energy he's put into it. So I gave him this massive stack of paper, all crap, 100% crap, but it was thick. So he looked at one. I mean, I can still remember, he looked at one, then he looked at another one, and then he just sort of got the edge of it, like you might flick the side of a wad of notes, and he was just flicking the paper just to sort of get a sense of how many sheets there were. And there were loads. I mean, it was garbage, but there were loads and loads of it. And he said, I'll tell you what, why don't you come in for a couple of weeks? So yeah, I went in. And I think that at the time, or until recently actually, I would have thought that was sheer hard work got me that chance. But actually, I kind of come to realise that if he had felt so embarrassed that he'd forgotten me and I'd done a lot of work, it was the combination of those two things. That's, you know, so when people say it's all about timing, the timing was, he felt a bit awkward. He completely forgot me. He's given me a brief and this kid has done a big shed load of work. He didn't even remember seeing me. So I think the combination worked well. So that ended up, I went in there for a trial. I think in my first month, I did a TV commercial.
Yeah.
Weirdly, because I didn't really know anything about it, but I'd done this animated rip-off for a product called Hippopotamus that was essentially a rip-off of Fantasia.
I remember that. Hang on, you did that ad?
I did that
ad. I remember that ad really well. Like, it was
from your childhood.
Come on, dive in.
That's it, yeah.
Yes. Oh, my God. Well, I didn't know you did that.
You remember that. Well, that was the first piece of creative work I ever did, ironically.
Wow.
I've been there. I didn't have a clue about advertising. And the thing was called Hippopotamus. And my thinking was it'd be funny to have them swimming about and diving. And so I think someone else wrote the end line, come on, dive in, and made sense of it. And they made it. And then from then on, I spent all my time as this kind of slightly freaky guy who just used to do TV on his own, which was unusual to work on your own at the time. So I did lots of commercials after that one at this place called Brooks League in Bloomfield. And that was my first job. So that was from 85 to about 88 when they fired me. So I made lots of commercials, all kind of sort of rip-offs of stuff that I liked. You know, so I did this Hot Point campaign with a director called Nick Lewin that was attempting to be like Jean-Paul Goude, whose work I loved and still love now. And it was slightly crazy, surreal stuff, and I tried to write one of those. And obviously, if you know, you can't really copy someone's sensibility. I gave it my best shot. And then it depends on who you get to direct it. And it was okay. You know, it was very, quite creative for the terrible agency I was in. But so I made lots of commercials there. Got fired.
What did you get fired for?
I don't really know. I made a lot of work there. I was very, you'll find this hard to believe, I was very opinionated, which people don't really want to some degree. You know, I was very young. I was like, you know, perhaps 23. You know, I'd have views on what was good work and not good work. I don't really know why, given because I'd have one job at one bad agency. And I don't know, I was probably just a bit of a pain, you know. I think they wouldn't let me near any art direction because they didn't think my drawing was good enough. So I would do ideas and they'd give it to a girl who was better at drawing than me. And eventually, I don't know, I just got fired. I got fired about 2 weeks before I committed on a house, which was not great. At the time, I think that was about 88. So within 2 months, I'd got another job for twice as much money, just completely lucked out with a really good writer called Alistair Wood, who was much more senior than me and slightly on his coattails, I guess. I got a job in a place called Cromartyston that was supposedly being overhauled by a guy who just left GGT, which was one of the agencies at the time. At that point, it was, you know, Dave Trock was running it and it was a great agency. He'd fallen out with Dave and had taken over this agency and was going to turn it around. Again, I did loads of work. I think the first ad in between that break, between when I got fired and when I got that job, I'd sat in an agency called Elgie Stewart Smith and I'd done a poster for The Observer that was about moving home. And I'd done this poster that was the house in the Waltons. I don't know if you remember the Waltons.
No.
Goodnight, John Boy.
Oh, the TV show. Yeah.
Yeah. And basically the poster was that house and it said, Goodnight, John Boy. And then another with a little arrow pointing to one of the windows. And it said, Goodnight, Mary Lou. Goodnight. And then there was like about 100 names. And it said underneath, if you need a bigger home, take a look in the Observer job section.
Nice.
The creative directors really liked it. They took it to the Observer and they came back. And they said, good news and bad news. The good news is the clients bought it. So I said, oh, that's amazing. I thought, God, that's the first 48 sheet I would have ever done. The bad news is they want to do it as a radio ad. So I was absolutely heartbroken. And I thought, the radio ad, who the hell needs a radio ad? So they made it into a radio ad. And that, ironically, was the first ever award that I won. It got into DNAD as a radio ad. Might not have got in as a poster, but it got in as a radio ad, and it got a Creative Circle Gold as a radio.
Wow.
I would then have it in my book as the only thing that had ever won an award, and we'd look at everything. There'd all be drawings of all sorts of things. We'd get to a finished ad that got in DNAD and a Creative Circle Gold, and I'd say, and I've got this, which is, and they'd go, what is it? And I'd say, it's for the Observer. Oh, great. Well, it's obviously good if it won an award, so great. I said, shall I play? Shall I put it in the? No, it's fine. I'm sure it's good. If it's got into DNAD, it's probably good. So even the people I would see couldn't be asked to listen to it because it was radio. So it never got an airing. You know, it's the one thing I'd won an award for. I could never get anyone to listen to it. Went to Chrome and Titterton, got lots of work out. A few bits got into Creative Circle, nothing in DNAD. Got fired after about 18 months, probably for having opinions again. Funnily enough, the MD was Gary Stolkin, now of the talent business fame. He was a very young guy at the time. So I left that, went to a job at an agency called Edwards Martin Thornton, which I'm guessing you've never heard of.
You're right.
Now, Edwards Martin, when John Hegarty, John Bartle and Nigel Bogle left TBWA to start Edwards Martin Thorne to start BBH, the people who, their other halves, took over TBWA. So John Hegarty worked with Chris Martin. Bob Edwards worked with alongside Bogle, and that was like the other half. So they then run TBWA for another couple of years when BBH left, and then they broke away. So kind of big things were expected of them, and that just didn't quite happen for them for whatever reason. But they were all very bright and very well-schooled and knowledgeable. It just didn't quite happen. So I spent a couple of years there, got, I guess, my second award, which was a trade ad for Tenants LA, which was a massive close-up of DPS, close-up of a can that said Best Before, and then it listed all the competitions, so Best Before, Caliber, something. Yeah, and that
go in the book, got into it.
I then started working with a writer called Mike McKenna. We were working after hours, trying to get a book together. And I had two jobs offered at the same time. One, which was at the very glamorous Chiat Day London, which was being run by Kez Gray and Jonathan Greenhalgh, to work with an American writer called David Shane, who's now a good TV director.
Yeah.
The other was at Publicis International, when international meant, it's another word for shit, really. It was international now, so it's slightly more glamorous. Then it was like meant not as good as the English bit. So because I sort of made a commitment with Mike, I kind of took that, really. Slightly daft, but, you know, I felt it was a decent bit to do. I ended up being there for 2 years. We did lots of work for free. So the work that we would do in the agency was average. We wouldn't get very many good briefs. We were looked down upon because we started off in the international bit, and then they folded that into the main agency. So what we used to do is contact people like Boxing News and say, we'll do your advertising for free if you let us do what we want. And there were lots of things within the industry, like IPA posters. We did lots of IPA posters. Every month there would be a talk by someone on some subject, and they would print a poster. Mike was on the committee, and he would get lots of the briefs for those. And I think we managed to get a couple of those in DNAD. We did ads for O'Connor House, retouching, Boxing News, all sorts of things. We had a real big bunch of stuff that we'd done for free that was a bit better than what we'd been doing.
And at this point, just out of interest, are you starting to get better at art direction? You're doing more of the actual, you know, proper craft of the job?
I guess so, yeah. I think, I used to, all of these free things were, I would do with my mate who was a photographer. So I'd met him he was a badly treated assistant and he wanted to be a photographer. And we used to do lots of these projects together. So IPA posters for, you know, the budget would be literally £50, or an O'Connor Douse ad that they ran in campaign and their budget would be nothing. So me and Mike would write them and he would shoot them for free. And we did loads of them together like that. And that was Malcolm Bembo, who obviously went on to be a good director and photographer.
Yeah,
we were hustling these things. I guess I was starting to have more of a view on art direction. I was trying a few things. You know, with Boxing News, I sort of wobbled the type around on a stat machine, which was a bit crazy at the time. You know, this is pre-Adobe. This is when things were done on film and stuff. So I was sort of messing around with things like that. I guess that was the time when there was David Carson. That was the sort of David Carson era where there's a lot of fucking around with type, and most of it was garbage, frankly. But I suppose it loosened people up a bit to try things. So I was trying a few things like that and having views. But it's, you know, if you look back at old DNADs, you'll be surprised at how similar all the ads are. You know, there was a sort of way of doing things, and people didn't really, you know, before possibly 1990, you won't see much type in colour or many coloured panels. It was all black type and certain fonts, and, you know, it was a certain way of doing things. And to some degree, I would, you know, it takes a while to be confident enough to do things that you haven't seen, or to try, or to think, well, I like that. Who knows whether anyone else would like it? But I was starting to sort of play around and get a bit more confidence, I guess, in my own opinion. You know, I'd be looking at everyone else, like Mark Reddy and Steve Dunn, and what those guys were doing, and probably still would be mimicking them to some degree. They seem to be doing lots of the best work. You know, I would have preferred their stuff to Abbott Mead's, and which seemed a little bit
middle class, sensible.
Middle class, yeah. And sensible at the time. So I don't know what relevance this next bit has, because I can't tell many stories about it. But I then went to Delaney Fletcher Delaney. 3 months later, I got a call from Simon's Palmer. Now, one thing I will say is, all through this time, now that's, let me add this up. So 3 years at Brooks Legan, 2 years at, 1 year at Cromer's, what's that, 4, 2 years at Edwards Martin, and then another 2 years at Publicis. What is that, about 7 or 8 years?
Something like that.
All unremarkable agencies. But at the time, I would be going to see John Hegarty and Tim Delaney and all of the best people, and Chris and Mark at Simon's Palmer. And they would all say, yeah, it's interesting. We'll like your stuff. Let's think about it. And then they'd think about it and not give me a job. And then I'd get called in 6 months. And they'd think, well, they know my stuff. It must be a job. And then they'd get called in. Let's have another look. What have you done since then? It wasn't even 6 months, but there's only a couple of bit. I go, okay, and not give me a job, which was tough, you know, because it was like I was working in the fourth division. It's like getting a call from Arsene Wenger and then going to play back against Scunthorpe on a wet Thursday night. And you think, Jesus, there's such a big gap between the two. I just couldn't break into it. So anyway, eventually Chris and Mark phoned up and said, can you come in? We want to chat. And they said, we want to offer you a job. So within 24 hours, I also got offered a job at BBH and Legas Delaney. So once someone had come in, the others said, well, we will offer him a job. And now they hadn't. They'd had 8 years, and I'd been seeing them for a long time. But it needed someone, even at that level, it needed someone to say, yeah, we're going to give him a job. You think he's all right? And I had this little 24-hour period where I thought, well, what do I do? I kind of felt Chris and Mark had offered me the job first. It was probably the best place of all of them at the time. But the others, you know, BBH I'd been trying to get into for 7 years, you know. But it's just strange that they wouldn't, you know, you would think somewhere like that would have enough confidence or an opinion to not need it verified by anyone. And I don't know what the reason was, where it happened within 24 hours. But anyway, I then went to Simon's Palmer. Each of the agencies I'd been at, you know, the worse they were, the more chat there was around the work. So the very first one, there would be all sorts of technical chat about, you know, I'm trying to think of what it would have been, but lots of buzzwords and it, very scientific, the whole approach. It would be, when it got to Simon's Palmer, Chris and Mark would come round, have a look at the work on the wall, go, nah, I don't think there's anything there. All right, let's have another look tomorrow. That would be it. And then maybe if they liked something, the next day you might go, oh, I quite like that one, that's funny. Yeah, let's do that. And that's it. There would be no, let's get inside the mind of the consumer, what they really think, what makes them tick, why do they have this suit rather than that suit? What's the real dynamic going on? It's just like, we all knew the brief. It's like, oh, that's funny, yeah, let's do that one. And I was just struck by how straightforward it was, which made it, in a way, it made it dead clear, but it also made it hard because there was nothing getting in the way of it. You either did something that affected them and they said, oh, I like that. Yeah, it makes me laugh, or it's unusual or something. or you didn't. There was nowhere to hide. There was no, well, I guess that's totally on brief and it's this thing. And yeah. It was like, it affected them or it didn't. If they liked it, it happened. If they didn't, there was nothing that would save them.
Which is what happens with the public seeing the ad as well, I suppose. They don't sit there and go, oh, absolutely. Well, I guess the strategy is, you know, really quite interesting for the category, so I'm going to go and buy this washing machine.
Absolutely. It either cut through, it either tickled something. It's like that smile in the mind or one of those things. You know, it either created the smile in the mind, and they go, oh, I quite like it, or it didn't. And dead straightforward, but tough. You know, it was tough to get them to like stuff. You know, you'd have to really, really grind out the work. Every day, come around about 5, have a look at the wall. Heartbreaking when they go, yeah, keep going. because you could really, you know, you would get in, there would be very, very few meetings, just sit there almost in the dark, cup of tea, just what about this all day, and at the end they'd say, yeah, keep going. But if they said they liked something, it would be 98% chance it would get sold, and it would be 95% chance it would get into DNOD.
Can I just ask, just because there's like another aspect that other people might find interesting here. So you were working with Mike before, a publicist, and then you moved, according to what I've seen in DNAD credits, without Mike. How did that happen?
How did that happen? So we went to Fletcher. So each of my moves, the ones I've just detailed, would be, I started off at somewhere, I don't want to be too horrible to them, but I started off at somewhere terrible, and then I got into somewhere slightly terrible, and then somewhere okay-ish, and then not bad. I mean, there were micro moves up. And then me and Mike went from publicist, which wasn't very good, to Delaney Fletcher Delaney, which was better than publicist. But still, it wasn't Simon's Palmer or BBH or any of those. So we got there for 3 months. So at that point, it was the best place we'd been. It was good. We were reasonably senior, I guess. And I knew the guy, Brian Stewart, who was their head of art, who tried to get me in, and he sort of got me in. He was the steward of L.V. Stewart Smith. He'd known me since back then. So I'd been there 3 months. Again, we worked very, very hard. We did lots of stuff. Lots of stuff was happening. 3 months in, I got a call. Now, me and Mike were seeing Simon's Palmer together with our book. A few times a year, they would call us in. And 3 months in, they called. A job came up for just an art director. So they called me. And when they first offered it to me, because I'd only just got there and I felt so uncomfortable, I said, oh, I'm going to have to think about it because I've only just joined here. You know, which is interesting in retrospect. It's a ridiculous thing to. I'd spent 8 years trying to get in somewhere good. The best place in the country had offered me a job. And I was thinking, well, hang on, I've only just joined, which is irrelevant, really. It's embarrassing to leave somewhere where you've been 3 months. But, you know, using the football analogy, if you're at Scunthorpe and Alex Ferguson calls to go to Manchester United, you just have to do it. It doesn't matter whether you've been there a week or 3 months or whatever. But it took me a little while to get my head around. So when I resigned, there was a lot of pressure that they said, oh, they're going to fold. We've heard they're going to fold. They've got financial problems. And then they said, before we accept your resignation, we want you to write, which I still have, we want you to write a pros and cons, them against us, which is embarrassing, you know, really embarrassing. And then I had to show them, which is even worse, because I had to write things like, work, they're really, really good. Obviously, because I'm showing them, and I'm going, and you're really good, they've got two really, you've only got one really, you know. So I had to sort of weight it in. I couldn't say, they're really good, you're a bit average. So I had to come up with this piece of paper that was supposedly balancing the pros and cons, but didn't piss, you know, I didn't want to be offensive to them, but went through all the things, and obviously it was if anything, the minute you start going through, let's compare their work to their work, let's compare how much I'll learn there against here, let's improve, you know, there was no contest, so it was awkward, it was embarrassing, you know, one of the guys took me and Mike out, now Mike is about 6'6", and I won't say which guy it was, took us both out for a drink and said, I really don't think you should leave, and here are the reasons, and he told me, various reasons. He said, and the other thing is, if you go, he's out the door straight away.
Really?
Yeah. And Mike, you know, I think in retrospect, he wasn't serious. He was just trying to make me feel bad, you know, which worked, made me feel terrible. So, yeah, it was awkward. It was really awkward. I'd only been there a bit, but, you know, the fact that The other two agencies, Lee Gustavini and BBH, had offered me jobs on the strength of Simons Palmer offering me a job so quickly. He said everything that, you know, you just need someone good to give you a vote of confidence when you start in the business. You know, it's taken me a long time to get to that point. Some people like you, Ben, start at me.
No. I started at Y&R under Mike Cousins. And so I found it fascinating. You interviewed him the other day because that was a sort of weirdly medium place. But we, anyway, longer story that's sort of more about me. But I didn't work through the places you worked through, which is why partly I find your story really, really fascinating. But we started at the middle, I guess, West Ham, and then moved on to Arsenal. So, it was easier, but it wasn't quite starting at Evermead.
Okay, so you're at Simons Palmer, and obviously
I'm at Simons Palmer.
The CD-ing's better there, and the work's better, and the briefs are better. You don't have a partner, or you were put
I
with
had
someone?
A partner. I was with. I went to work with a guy called Mark Goodwin.
Oh yeah, very good.
And it was an unusual agency in that you just sat in your room and churned out ideas all day long. Barely any meetings. You never met any clients. There was very few ads not sold. I mean, it seems ridiculous now. So if you take out all of that, and it's all about just creating stuff. And then when you've created that stuff, the question is it good enough? It becomes very simple, but really very, very hard. So it was great. So I was loving it, trying to get Nike posters out. I did one for Nike there that I art directed. It looked like a Nike poster in their font and said it was about rugby. It said boot suppliers to the England rugby team, cobblers to the New Zealand rugby team or something like that. And I remember showing Mark Denton and he said, yeah, great. That looks really good. Why don't you do one that looks nothing like that? I said, in what way? He said, I don't know, I'd be interested in just seeing something that's, I like that, it's good, but try doing something that's nothing like that. God, what a man. I want to do things that look like the Nike posters that are winning awards. I don't want to do something that looks nothing like it. Anyway, so I had to work on it and did something. In fact, it was a different one that said tourist information. And I did something that was based on a Dutch typography thing. But he said, yeah, and eventually he kind of said, yeah, I prefer that. Let's go with that. Look nothing like a Nike ad. I would much rather have had something that looked like all that famous Nike stuff that was winning awards. But it, like a lot of the stuff that got in the book for typography. And in retrospect, I've talked to Mark about it. I said, why did you do that? You know, who's got time to say, looks great, why don't you just try another? He said, we just didn't have that much work. You know, it's just thought we might as well keep going. We weren't that busy. So although they were very hugely successful in the awards, they weren't huge. At that point, it's almost so. I think within about 5 months, my writer had left to join his old art director at BBH. So then we were going through the process, working on my own. Then we were going through the process of getting me a new writer in. And then coming up towards the end of the year, I was working on a brief. 5 o'clock, Chris and Mark didn't turn up. Hung around 7, still not turned up. 8 o'clock, still not turned up. I thought, God, that's unusual. They're normally spot on. Went home. And about 9 o'clock, I got a call from Mark Denton saying, oh, hi, Dave, it's Mark. And the first thing that went through my mind was, oh, Jesus, he's going to fire me, which is ridiculous, really. Why he would wait for me to go home? I'm fine. It's crazy, but he just didn't phone me at home, and it was just such a weird thing. So he said, oh, we just got some news. We've just been fired. So I said, are you kidding? And he went, yeah, but I've spoke to several people about you. And I think if you speak to this person and that person, it'll be fine. I think, you know, and I thought, God, that's unbelievable. He's just been fired from his own agency, and he spoke to people about me. So I remembered that neither of them drove. And I said, look, do you want me to drive my car in to take your books out? Just shows what I think is valuable. They had a massive library of all their reference and books. And I thought, obviously, that's the crucial thing, not the millions they've been screwed out of, but that they'll get the books out, because they said, we're not going to be in the morning. So I drove in with Malcolm Benville, and we looked at how do we get all their books out, and, you know, in my open top thing. So then it was a bit confusing. You know, they didn't. I was gutted because, you know, I'd finally got to a really good place. I love Chris and Mark. They were like two of the smartest guys I'd ever come across. I'd started doing stuff that was getting in D&AD, and they were gone. We were about to hire Tony Barry to come back to Simons Palmer, who's going to work with me. And I kind of didn't really like the look of it. I thought they seemed like they'd just shafted Chris and Mark.
and it just makes me feel bad. You know, they've given me a chance. It makes me feel bad to just hang around and, you know, ignore the fact. So Tony Barry was at Leagues Delaney. So I said, look, Tim had offered me a job when I went here. If he still wants to take me on and you're already there, why don't we go there instead of come here? I said, it's really a bit weird. I don't really know who's in charge or who said what or who shafted Chris and Mark, but it just doesn't feel right. So he spoke to Tim Delaney. I went in to see Tim Delaney, who was pretty decisive, like he normally is. Right, okay, you come in here, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And I remember saying to him, okay, can I have something in writing? And he just laughed. Right, it's my agency, I'm telling you. And he said, do you want something in writing? I said, well, you know, just, yeah, it'd be better if I've got something. So he just picked up a scrap of paper and wrote, I'm giving you this job, Dave, on this much, Tim. There you go. So I went back, resigned. I then had the sort of first lesson about dealing with the press, which is I got a call from Campaign, and I'd never been in Campaign before. I might have been in there once, but and they said, oh, we hear you're leaving Simon's Palmer to go to Leagues Delaney. So I said, oh, that's right, yeah. And they said, and do you know much about Leagues Delaney? Or what? It took loads about Leagues Delaney and there, and Tim had said this, and it was all Leagues Delaney. And then at the end they went, did your leaving have anything to do with Chris and Mark going at all? It was like real throwaway at the end. And I remember thinking, I can't say no, because it's really disrespectful for Chris and Mark. And I said, well, yeah, you know, it's not the agency I joined, so, yeah. I went, oh, right, okay. All right. Well, anyway. So then I went in the next Thursday and I had a copy of Campaign on my desk, first thing, which I never got. I wasn't senior enough to have a copy of Campaign. And there was a letter on it and then a copy of Campaign. And the lead story was the owner of Simon's Palmer, Paul Simons. It said literally something like, business as usual, says Simons. And the whole article was Simons saying, yes, you know, Chris and Mark had gone, but it's pretty much business as usual. It's not too much of a big deal. People are in place. It's there's the clients are fine. It's not a big deal. It's just, you know, it's fine. And then it went all through the article, the lead story. And then the last little paragraph said, this week, art director Dave Dye left the agency saying the agency he joined no longer exists. And it was very cunningly, cleverly used, you know, because there was 1,000 words before it saying there's no change. And you have to go, well, I did say that. You know, I didn't realise that was the context. I thought it was talking about me moving to Leagues Delaney. So I then spent the next month going in with everybody looking at me like, well, I can't.
Oh, you had to do a notice period, right.
I had to have a notice period. Yeah. So every day there would be all the people who'd fired Chris and Mark, who'd read the RT, you know, it was awkward. But, well, what do? You know, there was all sorts of things said. You know. So then I went to Leagues Delaney. Do you want to chip in? I'm conscious I'm rambling on, but I'll...
Well, there's those little questions that sort of are occurring to me, like the reason that... Well, the reason I said, did you have a writer at Simon's Palmer is because when I've seen your credits in DNAD for that time, it's like you've got a whole bunch of different writers credited alongside you, and I kind of wondered a little bit, like, was it the function of that agency where people would just, one person might think of a line and then his art director's not around and just pop into the next office and go, hey, what do you think of this? And did that mean people just moved around a bit, and was that a comfortable situation? I just wonder if you go into that a little bit more.
Not really, not in the sense of Mother or some of the other agencies that are more loosely structured. It was probably more a consequence of my writer leaving, you know, so I would have done some stuff with Mark Goodwood. Then I probably had a freelance, like Giles Montgomery came in and worked with me for a bit. I probably did some stuff with other people there, and I would have done some stuff on my own. So, you know, it's more that I was at a loose end because Mark had gone. So that was it, really. I mean, the thing that I did pick up from there that I really liked and I did use at Abbott Mead was they would have a wall of work. And when they did the Nike campaign, they would pin whatever the best work was at the time would be up publicly. And if you thought it wasn't good enough or you wanted to go at something, you could pitch something in. And they would then peel things down and put the updated selection up. So you could always see where it was at and you could always try and beat it. Which again was a very transparent, simple system that was very hard, you know. And I mean, great when you think, well, I can do better than that. You do want to replace one. Tough when you've got something on the board about to happen. There's a 96 sheet and someone else comes up with something you know, 2 days before it's about to get made.
Yeah, I have a feeling like they just would never really do that kind of thing now, because that sort of chimes with some of the stuff Dave Trott told me about what things were like at his agency. You know, people would get sort of whatever the opposite of a pay rise was if they hadn't been that good, and, you know, all briefs were open to all people and it was all fine. And I just feel like these days something like that happening would be bordering on the scandalous and really unusual in an agency, but not
scandalous in what way, Ben?
I think, well, people would get a little bit, hang on, that's my brief, and would you, and, you know, we can't just give this to everyone. I think the whole idea of the best work wins doesn't seem to be something that's continued into the advertising of today. It was a bit more, on one side you call it ruthless, on the other side everyone's got a shot at being the, you know, the team that has a go. And when I worked on The Economist at AMV, it was kind of brilliant because it was the best ad won, and it meant that everyone could have a go and be the pencil winner. And I remember when it was either you putting them up or whatever happened, Peter put up a thing on the top of it going, beat these and win a pencil. And you go, yeah, well, I don't know what I'm really doing at the moment with my with the current briefs I'm going on, but I could have a go at The Economist and then I could, you know, do that. And I think it's a brilliant thing to have, but I just don't think it's the way things are at the moment.
Well, I think you're right. I think it's a more confused system. And I think there's not a lot of people confident, you know, like Dave Trott is very clear thinking and very confident, so he's got no issue with saying what's the best and that isn't good enough and we're giving you a pay cut and you're getting a rise. And I think there's not lots of, it's a very confusing landscape now, so I think it's very unusual to have that clarity where someone will say that's the best, that's second best, that's third, because, you know, culturally people don't like, it's kind of almost elitism and people are more anxious about that kind of stuff now. And I don't think it's a fairer system. I think it's just a more confused system. I mean, it depends on what you go into the business for. You know, the thing that I like about it, and I've always liked about it, is it depends on, I think, at its best, you know, advertising is amazing. You know, there are certain, well, Apple, let's say you're on Apple, there's certain things like To The Crazy Ones is as good as, to me, is as good as any creative thing. In any form.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, that's absolute art. And I think if you aspire to do things that good, then people challenging you and having that sort of a system where you question it all the time and you go, that's fine, because that's where you're trying to get to. If it's just a job and you just want to knock some stuff out and go home early and you just think, well, I hope something wins an award, but you're not really that committed or you don't aspire to something that high, then that's a pain in the arse. Someone keep turning it down because it's not absolutely amazing. But I guess, you know, certainly when I got into the business, the idea was that you did work that hadn't been done. You did work that was simpler than anything that had been done previously or that hadn't been seen. That was this, I'm not saying everybody did it or barely anyone did it, but that was the goal. Often now, it couldn't be more the opposite. You know, I sometimes get shown things where they say, they do a reference, is the script. It's not like, this is the idea, maybe we'll shoot it like that. The thing that's being shown to you as how we're going to shoot it is exactly the same script. I mean, it's just so, to me, it's so bizarre.
But I think it's also interesting that when someone else beats you to it, it really, I mean, for me, I guess it depends on your personality type, but for me, it really makes you go, God, I've got to try harder or be better next time. And I remember when Paul and I got an Economist brief that wasn't the straight poster campaign when we were at AMV, and we had, in, you know, we didn't crack it to the extent it needed to be for that client and whatever. And then you guys got it next, I think, and did those banknote press ads. And I remember thinking, oh, that's such a fucking good answer to that brief. And the best team won. And if we want to be the people who get a really good Economist campaign out, we've got to beat those teams. And at AMV, especially at that time, there are so many amazing teams that you were kind of up against, but it was kind of a learning process. And it was like, no, fair enough, Dave and Sean did an absolutely brilliant piece of work there, theirs is better, and, you know, that's going to be a great piece of work, and if we want to do something like that, we've got to work harder next time. And people don't
absolutely
get that these days.
I think as there's been more creative industries pop up, lots of them are better paid, lots of them appear more glamorous, the type of talent coming into advertising is slightly different, not just in terms of pure talent, whatever the hell that is, but in terms of motivation and exactly what you're saying. You know, some people would get beaten by something and say that seems so unfair because we had that brief and we had it for 2 weeks. Why has it now gone elsewhere? Some people will say, well, that's better than we did. Next time we can't let that happen. And we have to, why is that better? And how do we make sure that that never happens again and pushes you on? And some people feel aggrieved because they think, well, it's just not fair. And I think there's probably more people that would feel aggrieved now than would feel they need to really step up, I think. And I think, you know, obviously that's the one massive benefit of when I got into from these bad agencies to good agencies is all of a sudden you had to really concentrate because, you know, certainly Abbott Mead, there were great people all over the place, and it makes you better, you know, just people drifting in saying, oh, what are you working on, you know, that sort of thing of what are you working on, okay. And sometimes they may go, oh, all right, and you think, oh, I don't seem very impressed with that, let's keep going. Or they may say, yeah, I'm not sure about that word, that doesn't make it right. But, you know, those tiny little interactions can improve your work hugely each time. And if you've got good people coming in, making comments and seemingly very loosely, just over a cup of tea, talking about something, I mean, that massively improves your work. That's why it's good to be in these very competitive environments. But I think, you know, it's an interesting time at the moment. It's a slightly different time. And I think it, you know, I suppose I think it will change. You know, I think when you look, you know, one of the things when I've been doing interviews for my blog and I'll kind of look up someone's work, you can see the sort of ebb and flow of the business of, you know, particularly in America, it's slightly easier, I guess, because I'm slightly divorced from it. But, you know, you'll see the 60s is amazing and then the 70s is very flat by comparison. And then the 80s with Fallon McGilligan and Ketchum Van Bond and Giant Day and various other agencies, it all kicks off again and then it sort of ebbs and flows. And obviously we're not in a great period at the moment, but I'm sure it will change because fundamentally the things that businesses need from us, whatever we call ourselves, advertising people, communications people, are the same. They need people who are going to make their messages stand out, distill them down, make them catchy and seem fun and shareable and all of these things. And that's a rare skill. It's an undervalued skill at the moment, I think, but I think it's not something that's going to no longer be needed. We've obviously gone through a period where it's all been about big data and that thing has been pushed on the back burner, but I'm sure, you know, generally what happens is, you know, you'll get one new agency turns up with a slightly more radical approach that this is all crap and none of this is standing out or working or it's not affecting anyone or nobody's remembering it. And it sort of starts to catch and spread like wildfire and then it changes it. So,
but it's a little bit also what you said before about, you know, the kind of, not the brain drain, I've written about it on the blog a bunch of times, but, you know, there are so many other alternatives. If you were someone who in 1985 was standing on the precipice of, shall I go into advertising? There weren't so many interesting or appealing alternatives. And now there are loads. If someone said, do you want to go and design a video game? Do you want to go and do this app? Do you want to do this tech startup? You're like, yeah, 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 yeah. So it's like advertising doesn't quite have the same position of being spoilt for talent that it used to be. So perhaps the people going into it don't have the same, God, I'm so grateful to have a job in advertising. And they're like, eh, fuck this. If you don't like my work, I'll go and design an app.
Oh, 100%. I think that, you know, I used to be the external assessor at St. Martin's. And the one thing I remember from the guy who was running it, Clive, telling me, is it wasn't so much the talent of the people who got firsts that struck him. It was the fact that the minute they left, they were on to the next thing. And he would have to track them down and say, oh, good news, you've got first. But it's like mentally, they'd moved on. All of the people who got worse results were on the phone every day saying, how do we know anything yet? What's the news? What's the news? But it's that mindset of pushing on. And I think that it's difficult to say, but I think, you know, if I was leaving college now, there would be a million options. You know, my list would be even more diverse than illustrators, designers and ad agencies. And I don't know what I would be looking at I can remember clearly the sort of ads that I was seeing thinking, God, it would be amazing to do that, because I look at all my family laugh at that ad when it comes on, or that poster just seems so anarchic and naughty. I would look at the Winston ads. I don't know if you remember those, Ben, but basically the
cigarette ads, and I very clearly remember at the time, a government thing came in that said, you now can't talk about the product, you can't mention its name in time. There was basically, you couldn't say anything. So there was a campaign done by Winston Cigarettes that said, we're not allowed to tell you anything about our product, so here's a stuffed aardvark. And it was a picture of a stuffed aardvark. And I thought, oh God, that's so dicking it to the man, you know. That's amazing to just be that anarchic and funny, big fancy picture of a stuffed aardvark. I thought, that's so cool. Or there would be the Hamlet photo booth ad with the guy trying to arrange his hair.
Well, it was interesting that restriction that came in produced some of the best advertising in the history of advertising.
Because it became pure entertainment, which was slightly a dirty word. But I think that there's an interesting thing now, which is when you put things out on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or any of the channels, you don't put out ads. You don't put out things that wang on about your product. You put out things that people might share, and they share entertainment. They don't share, this is a really interesting story about the history of the company. You know, they put things out that make people laugh. So it's interesting that there's this divergence now that online, the people have lots of followers, put out interesting, entertaining stuff that's not always totally tied into talking about exactly how their pasta's made or what wheat they use. Whereas when they go on TV or on posters or any of the more traditional things, they wang on about the same old boring things that people would never share in a million years. And at some point, you would think they would have to think, it's the same people looking at these. If they wouldn't share it online, why would it work on TV? I think there's a lot of stuff that will come out in the wash in a few years that once it sort of calms down a bit, you know. And obviously ad blockers is a whole thing that may help us in a way.
Well, they've had this.
I'm sure you know that that's like something like of the people who know that ad blockers exist, there's only 1% who don't use it or something like that. And that's the only hope that they have, is that not everybody knows about it yet. But of the people who know about it, every single person uses it. So once that's unanimous, I don't know what the options are. Whether you're forced back in traditional media, I don't know.
But, well, there was a thing I read yesterday to say that Facebook and Google or whatever were creating a sort of coalition of good advertising. I don't know if someone had written that in sort of massive Saki inverted commas, because they were kind of saying that if the adverts aren't any good, then obviously everyone's going to ignore them. But if we have ad blockers and you know, if you make the content appealing, then people will experience the advertising and that would be great. But you know, the guy who wrote the article was saying people just don't really want to engage with advertising at all.
No, they don't.
It's just something that interrupts what they actually wanted to do in the first place, particularly on the internet. So how that's going to be solved, even if you manage to work out ad blockers. It's like the thing with ad blockers is, hey, we the public would like to do something, that is avoid advertising, and advertising's a bit shit and annoying and boring. And they're going, oh, we'd like to work out a way to stop you avoiding the thing that voluntarily you're allowed to avoid, and you'd really just like to get on with your life. And it just seems like there's a lot of very, very clever people who've got nowhere near a solution as to how that can be avoided in the future.
Well, they've got no chance of anybody. I mean, whose view would it be that they're good? The people selling the media space. So that's not an impartial view. And the second thing is, you know, there was a point in the 70s where people would say, oh, the ads are better than the programs, was the sort of common thing. That isn't the case now. So there's nobody who would think, yeah, I'd like to see good ads. It's just, I think if we did a survey, how many good ads have you seen in the last year? I would imagine most people would say none. You know, most people wouldn't go, well, there was that one and this one and that one. You know, they might be slightly overly harsh, but most people, I think, would just say, I haven't seen any. So there's no chance of them not using an ad blocker. And even if they were good, it's not something you want to see anyway. So,
no, someone said to you.
That was always their challenge, is that they, you know, on commercial TV, they had to see it. So the question is, how do you stop them making a cup of tea, or how do you deal with that situation? And I think that's been lost.
Well, it's true what you're saying about the fact that, you know, you're kind of forced to a little bit on TV in the old days. And that was when you you looked through the haystack and found the odd needle here and there, and people were making them well for lots of other reasons. I'm sure we could spend more and more hours going into about people trusting creativity back in those days and people not micromanaging the shit out of everything so that, you know, all the fun squeezed out of it and all this kind of stuff. But these days, you know, you're not, if someone says, right, I'm going to show you 1,000 ads and you're going to like 15 of them, you'd be like, I don't really like those odds. I'd just rather be shown no ads at all. And even then, those 15, you know, are they going to be better than that video someone just sent me on Facebook from UniLad about, you know, a tiger that's wearing a dog's costume or something? And you think, not really. I've only got so many hours left in my life. Do I want to engage with, you know, a giant corporation's messaging? Probably not. And I think it would be fascinating to know and speak to people who work in advertising about how much they use ad blockers, because I do. I'm kind of assuming you do, judging by this conversation. And we all know about it and we all use it. And if we're all using it, then, you know, what are we really saying about the industry that we work in?
Well, I think, I mean, I see quite a lot of young teams trying to get into the business. And the question I've started to ask them, because it's funny, when your kids grow up, you know, I've got kids of 17, 18, 19, 20. And it's only in the last few years, you know, when you sort of go through this sort of digital revolution and you think, am I just not, is it not my thing? And people talk about millennials and millennials, and you think, hang on, I live with five millennials. And they don't seem interested in advertising, following brands, or engaging with brands online, or any of that stuff. Is that just my kids? So I've had about 6 months of teams coming in, and I say to them, what brands do you follow on Facebook or this thing or that? And most of them say, oh, I don't know. You go, really? You're in the business and you follow none? No. Some of them occasionally will say something like, oh, Nike. You go, why do you follow Nike? Because I like the TV ads. Okay. Someone said recently, the last team I saw, the girl said, oh, I follow Absolute. I said, you follow Absolute? What do they put out? He said, oh, not much, but I really liked all those, the ads that they did. I said, what, the old ones, the press ads with the yeah, I thought they were really cool. So you follow them because of a press campaign they did ages ago? Well, I guess so, yeah. And I don't find young teams, again, it's not surprising, but they don't seem to want to engage with brands online. And my kids don't. And obviously, there's so much. I mean, the other thing there used to be, when people would say, you know, the ads are better than the TV, there wasn't many entertainment options around. Now, it's bloody difficult to keep up with the latest box sets and TV shows. You know, I was reading about Difficult People is supposed to be great in the States. It's so difficult to fit in the amount of there's so much stuff out there, you just can't squeeze it in. So to squeeze in something about some new salmon suppliers who've got some angle on, you just think, oh, I've got no time.
Yeah,
I'd rather watch, whatever it may be, girls' season, whatever up to now. Why would I want to watch?
Yeah, I'm sitting here going, you know, I've got They start streaming Larry Sanders on HBO Now. I've got like some Bill Maher thing to watch. And I'm going, oh my God, I've got too much TV to watch. I'm never really going to get through it. And I'm going to go and see a movie tonight. And oh my God, my day is full. The idea that I'm going to squeeze advertising into any of that time is kind of ridiculous.
What about that new Heineken piece of content?
Are
you going to make time for that 12 minutes of telling you how amazing.
But you want to engage in them, have a conversation online with them and join their Facebook. And someone said, you know, very clearly that I think it was the ad contrarian, because he's obviously the best in this area.
He said that,
you know, in some survey that the main driver of people joining or getting involved with brands online or Facebook or whatever was that you'd get some sort of money off voucher somewhere in there. Not that you really wanted to. And when I see a piece of advertising that goes, share your Patagonia story or share your Twix moment or share whatever this kind of thing is, I'm going, who the fuck would actually take the time to engage with some giant corporation's useless, crappy attempt at trying to, you know, whether it's a silent conversation, but they all feel they've got to engage in social media. That's the whole point of, you know, where we are these days. But no one's actually gone, hey, well, when I'm on social media, I definitely like go, oh, personal automatic. Let's have a chat with the personal automatic people about, you know, cleanliness and kids being able to do what they want. And it just doesn't happen. But no one's actually, you know, got any self-realization about it.
Well, this is it. I don't meet other people giving other points of views at any age, you know, whether they're just straight out of the colleges or they're, you know, people I grew up with. There doesn't seem to be any view that, no, there's a whole bunch of engagement going on that's really shifting products and brands and really shaping things as a generalization. There may be the odd one or two brands that have, I'm sure, benefited hugely from social media, but as a media, it's not difficult to find the shining examples. It just feels like people are just putting stuff out there at great expense in terms of the people at the client end and the agency end, you know, these sort of scruffy bits of content that just don't... We used to talk about, when we sat on CDD, one of the things we used to talk about in the early days was trying to do the best, I don't know how we put it, would have been a slightly fancier way than this, but the idea was to not compete with the rest of the ad break, but to compete with the rest of the evening. So you'd try and do, you know, Walter's film with the Lucky Star. The idea would be that you'd try to do the best thing they'd see that evening. Not to say that that was always achieved, but that was the goal.
Yeah, and that should be the goal. And
that should be the goal. A, I don't think people see that as a goal anymore. And B, it's possibly not even possible to do that anymore. I think there's so much since then, there's been a deluge of content that's now available to be streamed. I don't know. So, I mean, I guess the convergence of these things makes me think that at some point, it will change radically. At some point, someone's going to say, well, we're spending X million, and what are we getting for that exactly? You know, because although lots of the channels are now more measurable, the results coming in are not good. And we can measure them clearly, and what it says is that we're doing something wrong. We can clearly identify that we're wasting money.
And again, from what the ad contrarian is saying,
channels have been devalued, so...
The ability to measure them is even like called into huge question these days as well, because you'll go, well, I know that there's, and I've written about this before as well, but it's incredible, this sort of Google have got this incredible algorithm and they spy on every last thing I'm doing or whatever. And all that happens is I decide to buy a shirt and I change my mind and the shirt follows me around the internet for the next month.
Yeah.
If that's what an algorithm does, then I can come up with an algorithm. You go, hey, you visited that thing, you didn't want it, right? There's going to be ads all about that wherever you go. Bob's your uncle. And there's no further intelligence about it. There's an ice cream brand I buy regularly over here all the time, and now I'm inundated with ads from them. And I'm going, if you knew how much I already bought of what you make, why would you bother advertising to me? I'm like one of your best customers. Why don't you just leave me alone? But
I think also they have a negative effect. You know, I bought my wife some slippers from UGG in Knightsbridge and foolishly gave them some details. UGG send me an email seemingly every day. So a couple of months in, I never buy anything from UGG again. Every time it comes up, I think, for fuck's sake, it's UGG again. So I've gone from thinking they're quite a nice thing to I hate their guts, please go away. So that form of remarketing, I think it's called, is not helping them. It's not in terms of me and UGG, it's not helped our relationship at all. I will not buy any of their stuff ever again.
Well, no,
because I have to delete their emails every day.
And you just,
so that is progress.
But you just did buy something from them. And the idea that UGG is the kind of thing you buy every week or every month is insane. You're not going to buy any more UGGs for another 6 months to a year at the earliest.
You know, if they contacted me in 4 months and said, oh, we've got a new thing, I might think, that's quite nice. Maybe I'll get that for Kirsty. Every day, as you say, it's not like selling apples or... But they don't seem to have any handle on how they're putting this stuff out. It's like they've found one email address to someone. Let's absolutely bombard him until he buys another pair of boots or slippers or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff, although they've got my details and they can send me stuff, and it doesn't always help them. It's absolutely killed them as far as I'm concerned, as a sort of very, you know, example of one. But so some of these things, you know, they're related to big data. It's not always good.
Absolutely. I was going to say, we've probably got like a good hour and 20 minutes of this stuff now. And although I could very happily continue having this conversation for a while, I've got some sort of looking after children type things to do this afternoon. But also, I think in terms of the first chat we were having, we kind of got to an interesting point where you're just about to join Legas Delaney. So if we pick up this conversation at some point in the future, at least we know where the story is then going to continue. And if we go off tangentially and start whinging about digital advertising next time, that's no problem at all. So I'll see if I can piece this together in some sort of in some sort of way, and I'll hopefully if I manage to do that successfully, I'll let you know. And otherwise, let's arrange another time to continue the conversation. And
I mean, your hands, Ben, ask me whatever you want. We'll talk as many times as you want until you've got what you need. So, whenever you want to chat again, let me know and I'll crack on.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Dave, and enjoy the rest of your Sunday evening, and I'll be in touch soon.
Okay. Cheers, Ben. All the best. Cheers, Dave. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Bye.